So I will start off by saying I am a non-clinician as well. So I'm a public health trained, and in doing research in suicide has been, a little frustrating because of not only because of lack of data, which I'll talk about in a little bit as well, but in injury, in the section that I'm in, suicide is such a unique component of injury. And any other source of injury, epi that we do or work that we do in prevention, it's a lot of looking at the built and social environment and how that impacts injury. And suicide is very much kind of seen as real estate and mental health, which is very important, and no one would deny that, and it's vital to that. But it also kind of, and I'll talk later too about the, kind of not really recognizing or bringing in this social environmental factors can also impact suicide and mental health. So I'm glad to see that the title is so diverse, and we'll recognize those types of things. And today I'm talking about a project we did in doing the best that we could do with some of the data that we have in terms of public health surveillance of suicide and turning a specific eye to veterans, because that's the kind of work that we focus on. And yeah. Just to acknowledge the CDC, State Bureau of Justice coordinators for helping us out, making the data available. Brady Stevens at the Center of Excellence for Suicide Prevention in Western New York, for his assistance with this. I was supported on T32 when this work was done. And currently the Center for Health Equity is supporting me to be here now. I am woefully underconnected, so I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. And of course, I'm not representing the U.S. government in any of this. This is all opinions that do not necessarily represent the government or the VA. This is probably, if anyone sat in the last session, pretty clear at this point. For people who are in suicide research, it's crept up to be the 10th leading cause of death, costs a massive amount of money in the U.S. We know from the National Survey of Drug Use and Health, which is the only ongoing surveillance for suicide ideation and suicide attempts that we have in the U.S., that approximately just under 4% of adults will disclose past 12 months suicidal ideation, and less than 1% of adults will disclose that they have attempted suicide in the last year. It's important to note that suicide, suicidal ideation, suicide attempt, they're related, but they're distinct phenomena. So I would urge you to keep that in kind of in your view as I move forward in here, because I will be focusing, of course, on suicidal ideation. The epidemiology of suicide, at least among service members and veterans, has painted a fairly grim picture in the last few years. There's an increasing suicide rate among active duty. There is a higher rate of suicide among VHA utilizing veterans when compared with the U.S., and the evidence is equivocal when it comes to looking at suicide among veterans in general versus the U.S. So much of the data that we have and the information that we have learned about suicide among veterans has come from the VHA, and a lot of times I think that it is it's easy to gloss over that it's a clinical sample, it's a clinical system. So they're very different from veterans in general. And less is known, and we focus a lot on suicide and not necessarily suicidal ideation or attempts. So less is known from a non-clinical population standpoint, and also from other suicide-related outcomes. There's been some progress in the last few years that's been chipping away at this gap, or starting to build a bridge, rather, over this gap and what we know. Rob Bossert, who just spoke in the previous session, who's also a co-author in this study, piloted the Veterans Health Module that was added to the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System in 2010. Two states opted to participate in that, and in the analysis of those data, roughly 3.7% of the veterans in that sample reported past 12 months suicidal ideation, which aligned very well with what we have seen in the NISDA data, the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. But the problem was there was no comparison group. The Veterans Health Module was only administered to veterans in the BRFSS. Now, Matt Miller's group out of Harvard has done work with NISDA, and so they used the 2008 version of NISDA, and they were able to look at past 12 months suicidal ideation, and they found that there were no difference between veterans or people with a history of military service and people without a history of military service. They're roughly equivalent across age groups, that they used 18 to 25, 26 to 35, and 36 plus. However, their age groupings are not sensitive to what we've just seen lately in midlife. So we know that among adults in midlife, that there's a rise in suicide, but we don't really know much about suicidal ideation among this group. So the aim of our study was to compare the past 12 months suicidal ideation by military service history in a relatively representative sample of adults. So we used the 2010 Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System data. It's a national sample of non-institutionalized adults over the age of 18 across the U.S. In 2010, I think there were roughly over 450,000 participants. This is the world's longest in terms of ongoing surveillance system. It's a wealth of data, but it is 3 miles long and only about a half of an inch deep. It's the price you pay for trying to get 500,000 people on the phone to take a survey. And so the CDC administers, there's a core module, a core questionnaire developed every year, and states have to ask that. But then states can opt to add in questions at whatever they want to add in. So in 2010, five states added in a question about past 12 months suicidal ideation. Now these data don't get reported back to the CDC because they're not part of the core, and they're not part of any sort of CDC-sanctioned module. CDC comes up with their own optional modules that can be administered in the BRFSS. Those data get collected, but any of these, you know, that the state themselves added don't necessarily get put into the national data set that's publicly available at the CDC website. So this just outlines the questions that were asked. You can see that across states, the wording is very similar but not exact, which is not, from an EPI and survey standpoint, not a positive thing, but they were similar enough that we felt that it was appropriate and possible to go ahead and use one, act as if they were all, in the same way. And among those five states, we were able to get just under 30,000 participants. So what we did in order to use the weighting system out of the national data set, because another thing with these data is that it's critical that they're weighted. There's a combination of things that you can do in order to get state-level data read back into the national-level data. And I kind of explain it like a scratch-off ticket. So these people, say in Ohio or Nevada, who were asked, you know, suicidal ideation, their data are in the national data set. But that question that they were asked about suicidal ideation was not. But it technically kind of is there. Like, they have a response, it's just not in that data set. So by linking sequence number and the state FIPS code, that gives you a unique match for the anonymous participant that you can take their state data and put it into the national data. A lot of people would say, why would you want to do that? Because their state data is already in the national data, but not all of their state data is in the national data. So basically, we created a variable for suicidal ideation. You can see that the states that didn't administer this question, everyone's just missing on that. But this allowed us to subset our analyses when we weighted it. So only those people who were administered this were able to get, the weights were applied correctly just to those people through the subset statement. Fun with data. This is their question for military service history. We considered anyone who answered those four categories there to have a military service history, and then the people who indicated they never have went into our military history negative group. So MHX plus and minus is the shorthand I'll be using throughout the rest of the presentation. We pulled out several covariates, sex, age, race, ethnicity, educational attainment, employment status, and current marital status. As I said, BRFSS doesn't ask everything because they can't, but we did as best we could with at least the demographic covariates that they do include. So we also looked at the public mental health types of measures they had in there, in addition to suicidal ideation. So frequent mental distress, inadequate sleep, low satisfaction with life, and low social support are all in the core questionnaire for 2010. So everyone was administered those. Only our states, the five states, got the suicidal ideation question. So we had these five, albeit rough, kind of indicators for mental health from the survey. We did group differences between having a military service history and those who did not. And we busted out our age groups by 18 to 39, 40 to 64, and 65 plus, which is based on previous work that was among the first to show that there's some sort of bump happening that among adults in midlife in terms of suicide. So although this is suicidal ideation, we wanted to at least take into account that there's a possibility there's something that may be happening that's mimicking that trend as well. We don't really know. And the only other study before this that looked at that didn't the age group, as I said before, wasn't really sensitive to this midlife because it was 36 plus. So this is the results for the 18 to 39 group. You can see that there were no differences in any of the mental health outcomes for those with a military service history and those without a military service history. They had some demographic differences that we would suspect to see. There were way more men in the military service history group. They're much more likely to be married. But overall, their mental health profiles in these data were undifferentiated by military service. Now, when we get to the 40 to 64 group in midlife, mental distress, inadequate sleep, and past 12 months suicide ideation were all significantly elevated for this group. This is not what we saw in the 65 plus group. This group was also undifferentiated in terms of their mental health indicators in these data. So we did find higher odds for suicide ideation among the midlife group here, which is something that it's difficult. We can't compare directly to Matt Miller's group's analysis of the NISDA because our age groups are different. But we're not purely clear why we've seen this in this group. Matt Miller's analysis of NISDA showed for every age group there was no difference. Overall, there were no differences based on military service history. In this BRFSS data, we found that there overall, there were not. But when we looked at these specific age categories, something's happening in the midlife group that we weren't necessarily expecting based on previous research, the little existing previous research that we have. And we're not clear why that's happening. Could it be an era effect that's unique to the service period? Is this a synergistic effect between individual characteristics and service history? Or is this a recency effect? So people who recently have left the military, we know from previous research with the Vietnam era cohort that roughly 1 to 5 years out from military service is a period of heightened risk. We don't know if we've captured that here because unfortunately with that military service history question to be offered, there's no question of when they severed from service. But we did take heart in that this is not statistically tested, but the reliability of the measure of suicidal ideation in here, that we did get a prevalence that was roughly overall, roughly mirroring what we see in the general population from NISDA. So our estimate of 3.3% overall among people with the military history or military history service, that with NISDA and with the Veterans Health Module, about 3.7%. So it's not, you know, overly, it's not way off base. We're not getting like 6%, 7%, or 1%. It's roughly kind of orbiting what we've been seeing. So of course there are a slew, a boatload of limitations. We can't generalize the U.S. This was a 5-state sample out of the U.S., but it is a very robust sampling method that the CDC uses for the BRFSS. We're unable to examine subgroups of current or former military who may be at higher risk. So in the earlier session, Rob had presented some data showing that women veterans in particular have a very high risk for suicide. We know that certain subgroups, LGBT people, Native American populations all bear a disproportionately high risk for suicide, but we were unable to look at that specific breakout in this group. We can't speak to causality. This is cross-sectional data. These are very crude indicators, again, in the BRFSS. As best we can get whenever we can manage to have hundreds of thousands of people on the phone for 20 minutes. And then other variables may explain this association. So we didn't have anything about mental health diagnosis in the BRFSS. Matt's group with the NISDA data, there were specific questions about past 12 months diagnosis of depression or anxiety, and things that we would think that we would see that maybe account for this association between veteran status and whatever marker of suicide outcome that we have. And it's kind of been the topic of contention. So whether or not veteran status itself is an independent risk factor or risk indicator for elevated suicide risk. And so one chapter of that narrative is that it's not, and that it's mental health that's actually explaining this. So more of a mediation type of role. And I do a lot of work with LGBT veteran data and trying to get I'm with the Center for Health Equity in Pittsburgh. So expanding VA's mission for health equity to LGBT veterans. So I know that, I have experience with working with a social status that can get stigmatized when it's associated with a poor mental health or poor physical health outcome. And so I think that trying to say that veteran status itself can be explained by mental health is, at its core, a good thing to maybe say, because we don't want to say that veterans, there's something about veteran status that's elevating suicide risk. Because for LGBT, at least, it's like, well, what do you do with that? You don't want to say it's a risk factor, because risk factors are things that we concentrate on changing, and you can't change someone's sexual orientation like you can't change their veteran status. So the way that I would challenge us to think about this is the moderator of what's happening here. And so veteran status or military service history may actually moderate the association between mental health diagnosis and suicidal ideation or suicide attempt or our outcomes. So it's kind of another chapter in that narrative, but how we conceptualize this is absolutely critical for the types of analyses that we do and how we begin to make sense of the findings that we get from these data. So, you know, some parting thoughts. Asking about suicide is necessary in public health. There is no field of dreams effect. Maddie Gould's group did a really elegant study more than a few years ago now, that showed asking about suicide, even among, they used a school-based sample, did not increase any marker of distress or reports of suicide after the students were asked about suicidal ideation. So there is no field of dreams effect. You're not going to ask them and they're going to do it. There are more refusals for income. From a public health epi perspective, we have more missingness on income. But we ask that all the time, and we see that as a standard core demographic thing. There's never any question about, well, people are going to quit our survey if we ask them how much money they make. But it's often said, well, if we ask them these sensitive mental health questions, they're going to quit the survey. Not true. For the five states that asked it, some states there were no one who was missing for this. They basically said yes or no. And standardization is key. So if we can actually, you know, make an empirical argument for putting these questions on more surveillance than just one survey in the U.S., it's going to help with standardization. We had the limitation that the questions were worded slightly differently. That's a serious measurement issue. You know, we overlooked it here because, you know, it was difficult to have these data in the first place. But it is critical that we do ask a standardized measure. With the new nomenclature document that came out from CDC, the way that we discuss this is absolutely crucial. Assessing how we use AIDS, especially with veteran populations, as a covariate versus an effect modifier, and whether or not this is a kind of a double cohort effect. So this is pure conjecture, but you know, the younger group versus the middle-aged group versus the older group, the Vietnam era cohort came home to a very different set of circumstances than the group that preceded them and the group that followed them. And whether or not those types of stigma can have lasting effects into adulthood, we're not really sure. So whether or not some of these things are wrapped up with age, some of these things are wrapped up with service era, it's not clear. And then finally, advancing suicide prevention to look at social determinants of health. And you use ideation and attempt as beacons to map the ecology of risk, but to broaden what we think of as suicide prevention, because housing, employment, all of these things are very intricately and intimately tied with suicide risk. So that's so much to do. Thanks.
Do people have questions for that?
Okay. Yeah, maybe you mentioned this, and I just missed it. The data that was collected by the five states on suicidal ideation, it wasn't included as part of the national data that the CDC makes publicly available. Did you have to go to each state and they asked for that, or what was that acquisition process like?
Yeah, it was like a retreat. They go basically door to door to take care of those coordinators and get that information from the CDC. They have listed all the coordinators. The processes are varied by state, so some states will just give you their data without, I mean, if they're taxed on the paper. Some states require a DUA, a data use agreement. Massachusetts, I've did other projects that I had to get Massachusetts data, and they require you to go through an IRB. So it's, you can ask for it, it gives you right out, you have to fill out a form, or you can do another IRB. It can be a time.
And just as a quick follow-up, I'm sorry, the state modules, how were you able to identify the questions that were in this thinking?
Oh, so that, no offense to anyone who the CDC is a bank on their website. If they had a question, if their model question, it's not super reliable. So the only way to really know what a state has in that year is to go to their website or to email the coordinator and ask for the survey. The websites for these are as varied as anything you could imagine. Some states make their questionnaires available right there, and you can just download it and read through everything. Other states don't, and you have to ask and follow up with the coordinator to get the questionnaires that year. And just really quickly, the other thing, a lot of states have been doing this split sample system, and I noticed while they didn't really get to speak about it, Ohio, all the other states in there, all four states have everybody in their state. But you can imagine it's a very expensive survey for states to do. So what states will do is they'll take a large sample. So say Massachusetts has 10,000 people. They would say, we're going to split it down. So 5,000 will get questionnaire A, 5,000 will get questionnaire B. On both questionnaires, they have the required core. They have to. But they might say, well, we're going to ask questions about diabetes and smoking and seatbelt use. And so they can't exhaust people. So they'll put it in either one of those samples to split. But for 2010, at least, there was no reason. The questions that people were not tied to their split. It was just a random process of finding them. People got to think about that. It wasn't based on what we're sampling people from the city or from rural areas and this. Nothing like that. Now, 2011 forward, has been joked this year, zero for bureaucrats because they use a different sampling. They included a double component and a totally different, it's called breaking for the weight and everything. So we just need to know.
Any other questions for John? Thank you.